Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 315 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And today my guest is Damir Bentley. Damir is a fascinating guy. He is a productivity coach. And if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know that I am the poster child for someone who needs help in becoming more productive. I like to think I'm productive. I like to think that I leverage technology to the best of my ability to gain that added productivity, and indeed I do. But my Achilles heel is planning. I'm not a very good planner, and that's where Damir really shines. And I think this interview to me was personal and mind-blowing, in the sense that he's got some really great ideas about how to take that giant leap one small step at a time. So a fascinating interview. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So without any further delay, here's Damir Bentley. Damir Bentley, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it's terrific to have you with us today, Damir. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, so I think a pretty critical part of my backstory before we even get to my sort of how I came into a profession, because I don't really come from a long line of productivity coaches, right? And there's no real path to becoming a productivity coach. So how I really fell into this was my own personal story of burnout and overwhelm. So about 10 years ago, I was working in finance in New York, the typical story of working 80 hours a week. I was very proud of it. I mean, if you'd gone back there, I wasn't miserable. I was sad, but also gave myself that credit of the busy badge. The people who, whenever you talk to them, say, how are you? Oh, I'm so busy. But you can sense that they actually sort of take some pride in that. They're always saying it with intense pride. I haven't taken a vacation in 5 years, but you get the feeling that they were somehow proud of that, right?
Yeah.
That was me. And one day I collapsed at work. My friend who was there said I just sort of my eyes rolled back in my head and I melted. And they took me to the hospital. And after a couple weeks of testing, I found out that I had something called salaryman sudden death syndrome, which is
it's actually a real thing.
It's actually a real thing. You see it mostly in Asian countries, but yeah, I have the dubious distinction of almost killing myself by working to death.
Right.
And
that's exactly what they call it in Japan. We had a guest on. And she told me what the Japanese term for it, but the interpretation of
karoshi,
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Salaryman's
sudden death syndrome. That was the wake up call for me. I would love to say that I had some kind of religious conversion, but if I hadn't had that medical intervention, I think I'd still be trying to pursue that hustle culture lifestyle today. But of course, that was an iron wall that was thrown down. My doctor ordered me to stop working anything more than 40 hours a week. And at that point, I was working 80 hours a week. And so it was sort of left to me like, hey, I don't know what you're going to do, but when you go back into work next week, you got to start working 40 hours a week. So within 1 week, I went from working 80 hours a week to 40 hours a week. And within 2 months, I was down to working 2 hours a week. And so, I'm that person who's a person of extremes, meaning I was extremely rebellious before. I was extremely unproductive. I wanted my freedom. I wanted my flexibility. I didn't want to be consistent with anything. I felt trapped by consistency and discipline. And then I flipped and became almost nearly religiously excited about what was possible when you actually got productive. And I took that maybe you know, maybe it was even overkill going down to two hours a week, but it just shows you what's possible and how fast you can transform when you actually have a reason and you get excited about it.
Well, pretty fascinating. You know, it's somewhat akin to the story that Tim Ferriss tells when, you know, he wrote his initial book, The 4-Hour Workweek, and how he became obsessed with seeing how much he could offload and get down to just that, a 4-hour work week. You get it, you did that 50% better, 100% better. I don't know what the math is there. Yeah, down to 2 hours. So, you know, I'm fascinated by this. And the whole idea of productivity is really personal to me. I like to think that I'm productive. I like to think that I leverage technology to make me more productive in the legal space. But I still feel like I could do a better job of that. And I'm not always sure that I know what's the best way to approach, you know, trying to improve your productivity.
The legal space has some challenges that are unique to it, doesn't it? I think there's two main challenges. One is billable hours and the tyranny of billable hours. And the second is a really bad case of this is how it is-ism.
Right? Oh, for sure.
And you know, I cannot tell some of my legal clients. I mean, I can coach with them for months, and you just can't tell them that you have a solution to their problem because it's hard to get past their sense of, well, this is how it's always been done. This is how it is. This is how my boss did it. This is how I was trained. I have the distinction of working with so many different people in different fields, engineers, you know, head writers for TV shows, and of course, lawyers, doctors, dentists. And in the legal profession, it's one of the worst cases of this is how it is-ism, right? It's hard to get through to people and say, hey, I have a solution to your problem. And it works. But a lot of times they'll just come back and say, yeah, but Tamir, you don't understand. This is how it is.
Yeah. I think that, let me ask you this way. Do you see any difference in that trait that correlates with the size of the law firm? For instance, are larger firms more prone to say, well, this is how we've always done it, and this is how we always will do it, as opposed to, you know, smaller firms, solo small firm practitioners who might be a little more adaptable and changeable?
I mean, certainly. I think that the difference is the solo practitioners burn out so much faster.
Well,
just
yeah.
So much faster. And so they get to, I would just say the only distinction is they get to bottom faster, right? You know, and they, yeah. and the size of their pain is so much higher that they just have more willingness to try something new because it's just so clear that the way they've been managing their firm isn't working.
Yeah. And the scale of the effect is also much greater for the solos and small firm practitioners. You know, if you're burnt out in a large firm, you know, you have some resources and maybe some mentors that you can call upon and some ways to tread water a little bit. You're on your own and you're burnt out and you're not being as productive as you want. You might be looking at not being able to pay your rent and losing your home and you know, the consequences can be a lot more challenging.
There's no contest that the smaller firm lawyers have a harder road to hoe. I think with a lot of the bigger firm lawyers, frankly, I'm just trying to get them past the paper tiger, you know, and past that, oh, my boss would never let me, or this isn't how we've done it. And, you know, the second they actually just shut up and start doing some of the things I teach them, they're like, oh, you know, that wasn't as big a deal as I thought it would be. Or, you know, I thought everybody would howl if I did this, but I made the change and nobody cared. And in fact, now people are copying me, right? So a lot with bigger firm, you know, lawyers, it's an easier road once they get that willingness in it. And I'll tell you what, a lot of time with people at big firms, it's when they get to a point where they're like, if nothing changes, then I might need to quit. And that willingness they have to be like, well, you know, I'm ready to quit anyway. So why not take some chances and see if I could renegotiate a better way to arrange this? That often when they get to that level, then I'm able to really work with them. With the smaller firms, they have more willingness to change from the get-go. I don't need to convince them as much. Still, there's a little bit of reluctance. I think for them, it's just that they're genuinely facing a harder situation because they're you know, because A, of the tyranny of billable hours, and B, just the regular old difficulty of running your own business.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm a poster child for this to, you know, to some degree. Before I became an attorney, I always put a lot of stock in New Year's resolutions and getting a grip on what's coming up at that, you know, juncture, the turn of the year. And, you know, now in the business model, it's all about goal setting and kind of planning out your strategy for this year and the 5-year plan and the 10-year plan. So are we doing that correctly from a productivity standpoint? Is that the right way to go about a top-down, start of the year, goal-oriented viewpoint? Or are there other methodologies or other ways to look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a lot more bottom-up. Not to say that, you know, the annual planning, I don't really plan more than annual. To me, you know, so much can happen in a year that makes your 5 and 10 year plans irrelevant. I'm more of I really have my clients really just focus on their annual plan, break it down into quarter, month, week. So I'm really focused more on that. But I honestly think the size of the prize is bigger by focusing on the small stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard of this concept of getting 1% better in every dimension of your life, but I tend to think that with my clients, when we just go through every single part of their life and make everything that they touch 1% better, they start to aggregate these gains of time, gains of energy, gains of sanity. And it adds up to, I think we tend to all look for the silver bullet. And I don't think it's there as much as we hope that it's there. Where I really think we can get huge gains is by going through there and just looking at everything in our life. I think if somebody just brought the attitude, hey, for the next 3 months, every single thing I interact with or touch, I'm going to leave it 1% better than I found it. I think you'll have an experience where you progress more in those 3 months than you have in years.
James Clear, in his book, Atomic Habits, makes that observation as well, and that to make massive change, you stack these micro habits one after the other, and the goal is to make, just as you said, that 1% change. So when we look at these 1% changes of and improvements in process or procedure or work product, you know, what are we looking at from a productivity standpoint? It's just doing the job better, or is it doing it more efficiently, or in general, what would you counsel your clients to do to make things 1% better?
Yeah, let me use a client who had a law firm. So I had a client named Tom. He had he actually had two separate locations of a law firm and was acquiring a third. So he'd started small and had built up to a midsize. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
You know, three offices. Yeah. And the problem is, as he got bigger and bigger, he didn't really change the way that he worked. It was just the same way that he worked at a small scale, but then scaled bigger and bigger, bigger, which just meant more work, more problems, more communication errors. And so what we started to do was we just started to do the blocking and tackling work of saying, you know, I had him create a list every day on a legal pad of his annoyances. What annoyed you today? What went wrong today? So he just started making this running list. Well, I had to sit down and respond to this email. It took me 3 hours to respond to this email. And I doubt that person's even going to read what I composed after 3 hours. Okay, great. Instead of thinking about a better way to write that email, let's go even further upstream and say, why are you getting emails that require 3-hour responses, right? How can we create a system such that you aren't trying to fix upstream problems with your business by email? You know, an email tends to be the badly designed engine that you just keep pouring more motor oil into, hoping that it won't burn up, right? And so email is the motor oil, but we could also go back and actually design the engine in such ways it's not constantly, the parts aren't constantly rubbing together. And so what we did with Tim is we just started pulling that thread every day. At the end of the week, we would just review all of the things that burned up his time and annoyed him we call them landmines, things that just sort of blew up in his face. And then we started going upstream and saying, how could we design a system where we didn't have to write that email, where we didn't have to step on that landmine, where we could have seen that landmine coming further out, or better yet, it never would have came at all. That's how we started edging into creating better systems and workflows for him. Another thing I got him started on was documenting his processes through SOPs and video, through written SOPs. That's, by the way, just to define that term for anybody who doesn't know, SOP means standard operating procedure. It's just a documentation of how to do something the perfect way. So we had him create written and video SOPs because he had staffers who'd been working for him 15 years. And if that staffer was out sick, well, all that knowledge left with that staffer and they were up a creek. And so we started pulling all the information out of Tom's brain, out of his wife's brain who worked with him, out of all of his long-term staffer's brain. And we started getting it into a business manual. We started creating better systems. And it was really just the small work, blocking and tackling. But where we ended within 6 months was really a bit of a business in a box, meaning he got to a point where he emailed me once and just said, you know, if I want to sell my business, I finally can, because I've got this manual with all of the procedures, all of everything that we do, the whole customer journey, everything that we do to service the customer. If I and every single one of my employees left this company, you could still sell the business in the book of clients and restaff it. And every single person from the lawyer all the way down to the paralegals would know exactly what they were supposed to do. And that's where we got. And we got there within 6 months. And he had set a 5-year goal of getting to that place. And we got there in 6 months simply by starting. We just started. And we started with the simplest stuff, which was, what's annoying you? What's going wrong?
Well, what I like is that bottoms up approach and looking at what are the problems that are causing you stress, just as you said. And taking a look, and what I also like is that it's not a one-size-fit-all solution. You didn't say, you know, you've got to eliminate or offload it to somebody else, because, you know, that may be one solution, or, you know, creating a different type of process or procedure that would eliminate the cause of the landmine might be something completely different. There's no one-size-fits-all solution for, you know, correcting these landmines.
And we're not all ready to take the same steps, are we? I've had clients where I knew for a fact that there was something that they could get off their plate, but they weren't ready to take it off their plate yet. And so sometimes it's not just about the solution, which I agree it needs to be customized to the person, but also it's meeting yourself where you're at. What am I willing to let go of? What am I willing to change? And, you know, clients think that I want to get into the that I want to draw a battle line with them and force them to let go of something they don't want to. I would just say, fine, hold on to it. Let's work on everything else. And once we've worked on everything else and gotten everything else in a secure, steady place, you won't need that security blanket anymore. You'll be much more willing to let it go.
Yeah, we can come back to it.
Yeah, I mean, I just come back. They'll be ready. I mean, in my experience, I've been doing this coaching for 10 years. It's just a matter of time. If you keep working on the things that you're willing to work on, it's just a matter of time before you get willingness to work on the things you weren't willing to work on.
This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by the net profit CFO, Ryan Kimler. If that name sounds familiar, you might remember him as being a guest on episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, where we talked about his new company and how they can help you drive profit to your bottom line. I was so enamored by what Ryan had to say that I actually became a client. I called him up and said, I'm ready to take advantage of your expertise. And that's exactly what happened. So I'm now a very happy customer or client of the Net Profit CFO. But I'm also very pleased to welcome them as a sponsor to the show. So do you want to enjoy higher net profits without working longer or harder? As you learned on that previous episode, with just 9 simple numbers, Ryan will help you drive more profit to your bottom line, and he won't confuse you with all the details. If you want to increase your net profit, but don't like getting deep into the numbers, I highly recommend that you connect with Ryan. You can do that by going to netprofitcfo.com and download the Financial Clarity Dashboard. It's a great tool for getting the big picture of your financials. Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by my friend Mark Rockwell. Building a profitable law firm is difficult, particularly if you have no prior business experience. And sometimes even if you do, such as I did, you can still have difficulty building a profitable law practice. This often results in hard work, long hours, and low profits. If this resonates with you, you need to visit with my friend Mark Rockwell. Mark coaches individual attorneys as well as law firm leadership teams. Lawyers love working with Mark because he's different from other professional coaches. As a lawyer and businessman, Mark knows firsthand what it's like to overcome the challenges of growing a profitable firm. He'll help you do the same. Go to his website, coachrockwell.com, and download The 5 Mistakes Lawyers Make That Kill Their Careers. I promise you, you're not going to be disappointed in reading that. You'll get great insights on how to build a healthy, thriving law firm. Or you can give Mark a call directly at 503-784-7205. That's 503-784-7205. Or visit his website again at coachrockwell.com. That's coachrockwell.com. If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast.
One of my challenges, and I suspect that my listeners, you know, suffer from the same problem, is, you know, I put a block on my calendar on Sunday night to prep and review the upcoming week. And I oftentimes blow through that. Yeah. And I don't get around to doing the weekly planning. And so now it's Wednesday and I think I should have thought about that on Sunday night. Do you have any kinds of ideas of how to kind of build that habit and kind of work on weekly planning as opposed to going from day to day?
Yeah, I have some great ones. But if you'll allow me, I'll step back and say that you've really stepped on, I think, the most important, smallest change that people can make in their productivity. So I love where we've gone with this conversation. But if anybody's listening and they think, okay, well, but give me some advice, right? Mm-hmm. And I get this a lot as a productivity coach. I'll go to a party and they'll say, what do you do, Demir? And I say, I'm a productivity coach. And, you know, sometimes nice and sometimes snotty, they'll say, almost every person down to the last person will say, okay, well, what's the number one thing I need to do? Hey, it's occupational hazard.
Sure.
Almost like a doctor gets somebody lifting up their shirt and saying, right, hey, can you take a look at this? And you know, it's an interesting question because often I'll never see that person again. And many of the listeners right now, this might be the only time I get a chance to ever coach them, with air quotes around it. Mm-hmm. And so here's what I say to people. The lowest hanging fruit, the smallest thing you could do to have the most outsized impact on your productivity, is to plan your week every single week. Now, a lot of people out there are probably saying, well, duh. In fact, we actually surveyed 5,000 successful people who manage between 5 and 50 people, and we asked them what they thought the key to winning the week was. In almost everybody's top five was the concept of, you've got to plan your week to win the week. So this is a duh moment. I mean, every single person up and down the line, you ask 100 people, 94 people will say, well, you got to plan the week. Well, this is where it gets interesting. We followed back up with that 5,000 people and we said, okay, so if it's that important, how many weeks out of the last, or sorry, have you planned your week for the last 4 weeks then? So how many people out of 5,000 people, 94% of which said that planning the week was key to winning the week, guess what percentage of people had planned it in the last 4 weeks?
20.
Less than 1%.
Get out.
I'm not kidding you. So
I'm in good company.
You are in fantastic company. And as a productivity coach, I can tell you that people will bashfully admit to me, well, yeah, I know I'm supposed to move my week. I might have done it twice in the last 2 months, right? So this is something where we've got this giant gap between what we know we're supposed to do here and the fact that we are all simultaneously not doing it. Very similar to, a lot of people know how to eat healthy. Lots of vegetables, high protein, low carbs and fat. Just because we know it doesn't mean we do it, right? We might know it and still not do it. So what's up here, right? Why are you blowing through your Sunday night planning sessions?
Well, and I'll tell you what I do. And you can see how that comports with what you've experienced. I'll say, okay, let me think about this upcoming week. I'll look at my... Now, I have a very elaborate calendar. You know, I'm a tech guy. It's on every device I use. It's color-coded. It's shared. I mean, I make maximum use of my calendar with one exception. I don't do time blocking. But, you know, my calendar's... So my week is, I look at it and say, okay, that's what I got coming up this week. I've planned for the week.
Yes. Okay. So there's two things going on here. Let's back up to the first, which is, why do you say that you're going to plan on Sunday and you don't? And I'm not just going to make it about you. Generally speaking, why does a person have a strong intention, know that planning is going to work for them?
I'll tell you why. I think that there's going to be some more clarity generated by that step on Sunday nights, that I'm going to have more discrete and definitive things that I want to accomplish that week. That's the part I never get to. I don't get past, okay, here's what my week looks like. I don't get to that next level.
Got it. Yeah. So let me present to you why I think this is happening. So the truth is the very nature of planning your week is stressful. Let's admit it. I mean, what you're really doing when you plan the week is you're saying, hey, I'm going to take 30 minutes or an hour, and I'm going to accelerate all of the stress, anxiety, and fear of 1 week into that 30 minutes or an hour.
Well, that's exactly what happens. Yeah.
And then we think to ourselves, well, I wonder why I'm skipping it. Well, our animal brain is not very intelligent. It just knows, hey, this is a really painful process. I dread it a lot. And so your animal brain is saying, great, let's get away from it. And just like anything that you have stress, fear, and anxiety around, your animal brain will work overtime to get you away from it. And by adulthood, many of us have developed such a strong resistance to the idea of planning as to call it a revulsion. Many people are revulsed by the idea of sitting down and planning their week. And it's just the accumulation of that stress, fear, and anxiety. So this is what I call the resistance, right? The unconscious resistance that we have to planning. So the number one thing that I would advise people to is, you actually have to give your animal brain something to look forward to. And in theory, the best thing you could do is actually turn your planning session into a reward, not a consequence. So let me give you an example here that's classic. My wife and I were in Paris, and we used to be digital nomads. So we were in Paris for a couple of weeks, had to leave, you know, it was 11 o'clock in the morning, we had to check out, 11 o'clock at night flight, so we had all this time to kill. So we went to a cafe, it was a Saturday, you know, we said, hey, let's go to the cafe, get some work done, plan our week and all that. We go to this cafe, and I'm telling you, the coolest cafe we've ever been to. I mean, I'm talking about view of the Eiffel Tower, cool French people, croissants, lattes. I mean, like, just imagine the most, you know, picture perfect image of a French cafe. And we sat down and we planned our week, and you know, a couple hours, and you know, we did it in like 30 or 60 minutes, and then sat for another 2 or 3 hours, just sort of like talking and hanging out, just having a blast. And my wife left. When we were leaving and getting in the car, my wife said, God, I wish we could plan like this every single week. I mean, at home, it's like pulling teeth to plan our week, but this was amazing. I could do it like this for the rest of my life. And that was a huge light bulb moment for me. So when we came home, I found the fanciest brunch place that we could possibly find in our town here. And every single Saturday morning, we go and we plan our week together having brunch. So, you know, total French bistro vibe, the lattes, the croissants, the whole nine yards. We do it in 30 minutes and then we'll hang. And that's sort of like our date night, because we're boring parents now. So instead of a date night, it's like a date brunch, right? But I'll tell you, the quality of the connection that I have with my wife is unparalleled, because much of what blocks us from connecting, because we run a business together and we run a household together, much of what blocks us is this cloud of, oh God, what's coming at us this week? And, you know, are we ready for it? Are we prepared? Have we dialed it in? And when we do dial it in, we do a great planning session, and we have this high five moment. And I'll tell you what, we are so relieved, and we just, the next 2 or 3 hours of hanging out and having brunch is just unparalleled. So pause and just step back. I've turned the most dreaded moment in my week, which is planning my week, into a moment that I can tell you is my favorite moment of the week. Why? Because I structured it as a reward. And now even my animal brain is saying, ooh, can't wait. In fact, I don't go out on Friday nights anymore. I'll never go out on Friday because I'm so looking forward to those Saturday morning brunches. It's just something that I always look forward to. So this is what we call removing the resistance by taking your planning, and instead of trying to say, oh, I'm going to do a boring, terrible planning session, but I'll give myself a little square of chocolate afterwards. Save yourself the time. It's not going to work like that. But what we've done is actually made the planning session itself a reward. Now, I'll give you one more idea before I turn over the mic, because I want to hear what you think about this. I had another client who said, yeah, you know, Saturday morning doesn't really work for me. So he and his wife, before they go home, they've got a babysitter, and they just extended their babysitter a little bit. And before they go home, they'll meet up at a little wine bar on Friday night. So they don't go home. They meet each other at a wine bar on Friday night. They grab a couple glasses of their favorite Barolo, and they sit there, and for 30 minutes, they plan their week. And so it's sort of this little, okay, let's plan our week, and then we get to hang out a little, and then we go home and, you know, start our weekend. And so imagine what they've done for themselves. It's Friday night. They've already planned the week. They had a blast doing it and shared a glass of wine. And now all of Friday night, all of Saturday morning, all of Sunday, they're not feeling that storm cloud of dread hanging over their head. They're not avoiding what's coming for the week because they've planned it. They have a plan in place, and now they get to disengage and really relax.
Well, I think you've earned your pay right there. Because I'm now thinking, well, why don't we combine two major points that we've already covered? 1% improvement and turning the planning session into a reward. Because frankly, my planning session was, okay, somewhere around 6 o'clock, it's on my calendar, I can adjust it. I'll go into the office, my home office, and, you know, review the calendar and plan my week, quote. But now if I turn it into a reward and possibly also include my wife in that and make it 1% better by just picking out one project to add to the week that will improve the workflow in my office, I think you got something there, Damir.
So, I mean, if
you're,
I can,
there.
I'm glad. This is actually what our forthcoming book is about. And if you don't mind me just doing a micro plug, it's called
Not Do I Not Mind You, I would insist that you do so.
Okay, well, thank you. It's called Winning the Week. And it is basically there to show people how to plan their week in 30 minutes or less to maximize their chances of winning the week. So what I would advise to you is, what we've done is we've actually created a free training, an hour-long free training that sort of promotes the ideas in the book. So think about it as, if you don't want to read the book, this is a little hour-long free training that basically tells you what's in the book. And it's at winningtheweek.com. And it shows you how to plan a winning week. So for example, one of the things that you might not be doing in your planning is that we say, hey, choose a leverage priority, which a lot of people understand. Scan your time availability or your time supply. Scan your time demands, right? So your time supply is your calendar. Your time demands is your to-do list. Now, a lot of people will nod their head and say, okay, yeah, great. Set a priority. Look at my calendar. See where my time availability is and match it up against my to-do list. Great. A lot of people will nod their head and say, yeah. But the last step is the most crucial. Then calendarize your to-do list, meaning match your time supply to your time demands until there's no more time left. Now, that might seem like overkill for many people, like that's going too far, but I would suggest that it's just far enough. In fact, a lot of people will nod their head when they say in personal finance, you've got to give every dollar a destination. You've probably heard that. Give every dollar a job. Every dollar has a destination. Well, if that's true for your time, how is it not doubly true? Sorry, if that's true for your finances, for your money, how is it not doubly true for your time? Because you only have 168 hours every single week. So what I would propose to you is that a lot of people, when they say they're planning their week, they're stopping short of a step that would really turn their plan into an actual plan. And I would propose that if you're looking at your time and you're arranging your to-do list, but you're not marrying the two together, your plan hasn't really become a plan yet.
Well, as I said, I have the most elaborate, beautiful calendar, and similarly, an elaborate, beautiful task list. But you're right. And I confessed early on, I said, I do, my calendar does one, lacks one thing that a lot of people advocate, that's time blocking. So what you're saying is to take that to-do list or take that project list and put it on your calendar, time to work on it.
Hey, you know, I think about it like meeting the market. If I had a business selling truffles, rare and valuable and limited truffles, and I had an inventory of truffles, and then I had some bids for those truffles, right? I don't meet the market until I accept certain bids, right? I mean, until I say, I'll take your bids, I'm not taking your bids, right? I haven't met the market. I'm just sitting there with my hands out, right? You know, like I've got the truffles, I've got the bids, but until I accept the bids and say, hey, you five people are getting truffles from me, you five aren't, right? I haven't met the market with my product. Well, when you think about your time, you either sell your time to other people or consume it yourself, or it goes to waste. You've got 168 hours every single week. You either sell it to somebody else, you consume it yourself, or it goes to pot, right? And so if you don't calendarize your time, you're really not meeting the market with your time. Or worse yet, you sort of are coming to market, but instead of maximizing your bids and choosing the best bids, you just sort of like whoever walks in the door gets to have whatever they asked for, right? So it almost becomes like, you know, indecision is a decision and it's never the best decision. So, hey, I know I'm going long here, but I love this way of thinking about it almost like a business, because really, when you think about it, what else is it?
Well, you're 100% correct. And I think, as you said, many of us intuitively know that it's just, what are the steps we need to take? And I thought that I was bridging that gap by setting the planning session on my calendar and then doing some perfunctory step that I called planning, which really wasn't. And
sorry. I apologize. Keep going.
So, I mean, it comes down to really, I think in, for me personally, it's a mindset shift. I think some of the things that I've been doing with respect to productivity is counterproductive to what I think I'm trying to do. So, I mean, have you found that there's, you know, some typical types of approaches that or mindsets that people have that are limiting their adoption of what they know to be required?
I mean, you know what I've found with productivity? It is the least intuitive skill out there. Meaning, it's really hard to intuit what's right by just asking yourself what feels right. Often, what you feel is the exact opposite of what you should be doing. So do you feel like planning your week on Sunday night? No, but that's exactly what you should be doing. And that's just an example of, you know, productivity can, it almost feels like in the productivity world, if you feel like going left, you should probably go right. If you feel like going down, you should probably go up. It almost is the opposite of what your instinct tells you. I mean, I should be thankful because this is part of why I have a job, but it also means that really intelligent people can try for a long time to get this thing right and still fall short because their intuition has served them really well in other areas of their life and falls completely short here.
I feel like you're talking to me personally here, because that matches me completely.
So, you know, what's funny about the book we're coming out with is part of the reason that we wrote it is my frustration that I felt like people would say, yeah, I plan my week. And then I would hear what they did and I would say, that is not planning. You are not actually planning your week. And the highest compliment that I've gotten from people who've read the book is, for example, my publisher came to me and my editors, my publisher, and they say, you know, everybody in our company has read your book, right? And I was like, oh, well, that's great. And she said, I think what's blowing us all away is we're all sort of getting together and looking at each other and saying, I thought I knew what planning was. And I feel like I've read this book and I feel like somehow I've been walking around the planet thinking that I knew what planning my week meant. And you just completely redefined it. And that's what we're hoping to do is get out there for people who think they know what planning is and say, hey, you... I want you to be open to the idea that you might not know at all what planning is in a good way, meaning we can show you what's been falling short in your planning for so long so that you can actually get that result. And what we do at winningtheweek.com is we show you how to plan your week in 5 steps or less, in 30 minutes or less. Because at the end of the day, listen, this is coming out of your personal time on Friday night or on Saturday morning. And I found that people who spend more than an hour planning don't plan. Meaning my clients who spend more than an hour planning, when I check in with them 2 or 3 months later, they stop doing it. Mm-hmm. So speed matters when it comes to planning, because if you can't do it fast and successfully, you're not going to sustain it. So for me, you know, I'm on a Johnny Appleseed type of mission to create a generational change in this very small part of productivity to just show people, hey, this is it. This is how to plan your week in 30 minutes or less.
It's fascinating. And you've struck an enormous chord with me. And I can't wait for the book. When's it to be published?
The book is coming out July the 12th. July the 12th. It's called Winning the Week. And you can sign up for a masterclass that basically does an hour-long version of what's in the book at winningtheweek.com. But when you sign up for that, you automatically get put onto our email list for the book. And what we're doing, what that's really cool about the book is we're actually creating a lot of online educational components that go along with the book. So for all of our early, you know, adopters, people who sign up for the book list early, they're going to be getting access to, you know, some, you know, early adopter classes and books and downloads that we've complemented the book with.
Well, like I said, I am the poster child for this. So I'm going to be going right to that website just the moment we're done here. So listen, I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. We've mentioned winningtheweek.com. Is there any other way that you would recommend our audience reach out to you if they want to follow up with something you've had to offer today?
Yeah. I mean, we put a ton of really cool free content out on our YouTube channel, which is called Life Hack Method. So if you search us on YouTube, Life Hack Method, and subscribe, you'll get some of our fun little videos. And if you really, really want to check out the work that we do, you can check us out at lifehackmethod.com.
Oh, no. My Achilles heel these days is YouTube. So now I'm really down a rabbit hole.
So we've been doing it for a while. So there's a nice library of videos if you want to go down a rabbit hole.
Great. That's exactly what I'm going to do. Namir, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And I hope to follow up with you here shortly.
Neil, thank you so much.
It's been great.
Well, there you have it, fellow law entrepreneurs. Thank you for being with us this week. I want to thank our sponsors, Ruby Receptionist, a longtime sponsor of ours, my personal reception service, Mark Rockwell. Coach Rockwell is a very, very fine attorney coach. You would be well advised to look him up and consider retaining his services. And our newest sponsor is Net Profit CFO, the fractional corporate financial officer that, again, I am a client of. I can't recommend them highly enough, and I'm delighted to have them as our sponsor. If you enjoyed today's episode, please go to wherever you listen to your podcast and leave us a review and a rating. That helps tremendously in terms of making our podcast visible. Be sure to share it with friends and family. Visit us on our social media platforms. Just search for The Law Entrepreneur. You'll find us everywhere on Twitter, Facebook, and the like. So until next week, thanks again for being a listener here on The Law Entrepreneur.